Hello, welcome to the Purposefully Human Radio Hour, where we get into discussions with interesting people on creating a more human world. I'm Neil Woodson, and with me is my co-host, Jerry Seifert, and we're so happy that you were joining us today. Jerry, what's going on with you out there on the West Coast?
Oh gosh, it's been really interesting getting to know the area. We had an election. We had the Seattle Mariners make a run to, didn't quite make it all the way to the World Series, but it was very exciting. One thing I learned out here is this time of year, the big Pacific storms come on shore. And it gets very interesting for about 24 hours with high winds and pelting rain and things like that. Somebody described it as it's the cold ocean equivalent of a hurricane as far as intensity. And I understand over on the coast it gets even worse. Yeah, having a good time, enjoying fall here in Seattle and life in general. And what about yourself? What's going on with Neil?
You know, I read something this week. I didn't know this, and it's probably something that obviously we don't think about that much these days. But I read this, I think it was day before yesterday, and I just wanted to like cheer. And it has to do with polio. So, like I said, it's not something we talk about here. But I read that the number of polio cases globally has decreased by more than 99%. In just 35 years. Back in the 1980s, 350,000 children per year were paralyzed by polio. And today, that figure is 50. Not 50,000, 50. I think that that's fantastic news. When we're talking about being purposefully human, what's more human than that? That's just
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
so, in all this time of stress and people having high anxiety, and we hear so much negative these days. I read that and I was just like, wow, good news. That's really good news.
I remember standing in line to get my sugar cube because that's how they delivered the second vaccine. I actually got the injection and the oral because they came out back to back. But yeah, it was a community event, because it's such a devastating disease that people were ready to do whatever it took to be done with it.
Well, let's get on to the action here. Before we meet our guest, and we have a great guest, I just want to mention that this program comes to you from the Purposefully Human Community, which is a group committed to giving people a voice in creating a more human world with more humane organizations. You can find out more at purposefullyhuman.com or just go to LinkedIn and search for Purposefully Human. So now, without further ado, let's talk about our guest. Today, we have with us Sarah Andrews. Sarah is a 20-year veteran in the customer experience management world. She's the founder of and chief consultant at Cupola CX, which is a company that helps organizations design and implement a customer experience strategy that takes better care of people. Sarah, welcome to the Radio Hour. How are
Hi,
you
Neil.
doing
Hi,
today?
Jerry. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Sarah.
Is it still snowy where you are? I know you got a little snow this weekend.
More than a little. We had, I think, 14 inches of snow.
Wow.
Yeah, we're in the
Wow.
snow belt. So, whatever way the wind's blowing off the lake is what we get.
I used to live on the other side of the lake in Michigan, and we always used to watch WGN in Chicago, and we'd watch the weather there, and whenever they said 6 inches, we knew we were going to get nine.
Yep, Tom Skilling, the WGN weatherman.
So, Sarah, why don't you tell us a little bit more about what you're doing and what you do? I know you do a lot of work in the public sector, and I know you also do work in the private sector. So, just give us a thumbnail sketch of kind of what Sarah's about and what you do.
Yeah, sure. So really the way I came to this work is my first job in high school actually was for an all-female compounding pharmacy here in South Bend, Indiana called Marmaine Pharmacy. And a pharmacy like that is meant to put together medications that aren't commercially available. And so, in that work, a pharmacist is working directly with the doctor to understand the direct needs of that patient. And so, we know that anything commercially available is not going to work for this patient. And so, I would watch these pharmacists go to great lengths to really understand the problems of their patients and what we needed to do and what we needed to create to help heal them. And so that stuck with me. I worked at that pharmacy all through high school, all through college, and I knew that I wanted to go into some sort of work where you could be in service to someone else. And so that is how I found myself in customer experience over 20 years ago, and really excited that I was able to hang a shingle a couple years back and start my own consulting firm, so Cupola. And I live here in South Bend, Indiana, the home of Mayor Pete. And as Mayor Pete likes to say, we are big enough where things matter here, but we're also small enough to get things done. And I had the great pleasure of getting hooked up with the city of South Bend as we are getting ready to move from the current county city building, which is lovely. I think it was voted the ugliest government building in the nation. Was built in the height of Reconstruction in the 70s, and we are moving to a new county, excuse me, a new city building. And so they brought me in to do some service design work and really understand how could we create a space that was really here to serve residents. Instead of making a resident, pop to different floors of a city hall, how could we create a one-stop shop, if you will, on the first floor of that city hall where someone could come in and they could start a new water service, they could get a permit, they could enroll in some of our utility assistance programs. And so this was work, service design work that hadn't been done at the city before. And so I was so honored that they asked me to help do this, and an amazing, amazing group of folks around the table. So we had 30 cross-functional team members from across the city come together every month for 18 months to design what the new city hall should look like. So, doing things like empathy mapping of who are these residents that we're serving. And we came up with seven different resident types that we put into different personas. What are some of the challenges and constraints that they have outside of working with the city? What does that look like? What is their level of trust with the government? And we had to take all those things into account as we built the space and built the services that went into it.
Well, you hit on a couple things, a few things that I really am a fan of. One, you talked about Mayor Pete. I'm a big fan of Mayor Pete, and I'll never forget. Never could figure out how to say his last name, and
Buttigieg.
I was somewhere. Well, I saw somewhere somebody was wearing a shirt, and it said Boot Edge Edge. I'll never forget. I was like, Boot Edge Edge. There it is, Buttigieg. Got it. The other thing I'm a big fan of is the service design community. I really think the service design community gets it. Big fan of Mark Stickdorn and that whole kind of world, Lou Down and folks like that. And I love their emphasis on research and really researching people and looking at what does this do for people and what are these people all about and trying to understand what people go through to get from A to Z. And I truly think that's in some ways what businesses don't get. They just don't understand it. Whether it's a for-profit business or whether it's, local government or whatever, they don't get it. It's just let's put a train out there, put a platform there, and that's what people need. And they don't understand, well, there's a whole bunch of steps in that, right? And there's all kinds of foul-ups that can happen.
Well, Neil, that's why I was eager to have Sarah on the program. Because if you think about civic services, these are some of the most vital, urgent needs that people have. And historically, put your fingers in your ears, Sarah. Historically, civic administration has been very backward and very transactional. And it's the butt of every joke at a cocktail party, right? But Sarah's interaction with the city there just really put the humans back in the center of the conversation. And I'm sure you'll get into some storytelling, Sarah, about what you've been able to accomplish. But I want to move to your city specifically so I can go to New City Hall and have some request of them and experience it for myself because it must just be awesome.
We would love to have you in South Bend. And I want to be really clear, this was not just me. This was a huge group of people, willing, really eager folks from the city of South Bend, my neighbors, my friends, my colleagues, who did this work every day. We've all worked in this field long enough to know that sometimes you're in a meeting room and you have a bunch of prisoners there who don't want to be there and they don't want to do the work. This was not the case here in South Bend. I had lovely, lovely team members that I got to partner with who made this work go. So, I was just one small piece of it.
I fully understand about the prisoner idea. I spent many, many, many years leading corporate training and being in a room full of people who were there because they were prisoners. And the cool thing was I would recognize it. I would just go, okay, I know a whole bunch of you are here as prisoners. You're here because a boss told you had to be. So let's make the best of today, shall
That's
we?
right.
So Sarah, they're good people even if they follow the wrong football team.
Hey, I'm a Boilermaker, so when Notre Dame does well, that means more money for my city. So I always cheer for Notre Dame in that respect. But I'm a Boilermaker through and through. No matter win or lose, that's my team.
Well, I'm from Maryland, so I really like Notre Dame's lacrosse program. I can say that. But
There you go.
so I want to jump into our kind of our first main question here, and you've touched on it, and it's obviously very important to you, but I want to know, what is Sarah Andrews' definition of purposefully human? What does it mean for you? And put in the context of maybe how your work, I don't know if it started that way. Well, it didn't, and you saw the humanity in that work in medicine, and then now it influences your work in a different way. But what does purposefully human mean for you?
So when I think about purposefully human, I actually think about connection. That is one of my values, and that is actually why Cupola has that name. I'm Swedish, and so if you translate connection in Swedish, it is Kapala, Koppla, which sounds a lot like cupola. And for me, transactions don't fill my cup. So if I have a transactional conversation with a friend, I don't really walk away feeling really great about that. And so connection is the paramount for me when I think about purposefully human. And with that, I also think about intentionality. How thoughtful was that person in that moment with me? Or were they trying to just brush me off and move on to the next thing? To a little bit of the story earlier, I also think about being in service to someone else. So, what can you do for that other person without getting anything in return? I think we've all worked in probably retail or food service, and there is not a lot of, you don't get much back in those areas, but think about those moments that you can create for those folks. And I think about, getting it right, not being right, which as an oldest, that's kind of hard for me. I like to be right, but how can you work together in a process to get it right? So what we might not get it right on the first try, but how can we work together in an iterative process to get closer to what means right to the people that we're serving? So when I kind of combine all those, ingredients together, that's kind of my purposely human cake.
Kind of, so it's connecting people to understand people to be able to serve people. Yeah. If I'm
Yeah, there
hearing
you
that
go. You said it way better than
correctly.
I did.
Well,
But
I'm a
there
teacher.
was
I'm a
also
natural teacher. That's what I get. That's what I do. So.
the word intentionality in there, which I think is something, it's a word that we often drop, and yet it's sort of like the gorilla glue that holds it all together. Because I'm sure even though you had this over the moon experience with the city, there were probably days when you might have wanted to just stay home and read a book. But you were committed, you had purpose, and you intentionally wanted to be part of this group that was serving the city and the citizens. And that got you going, and you remembered what your purpose was, sure.
And when I think about intentionality, if you can both join me really quick, think about your favorite gift that someone's given you. Like, hold it in your mind. I would guess that that gift is probably not on like the Amazon, top sellers list. I would guess that that gift might be in your mind because of the reason that the person gave it to you. In opening that gift, you felt really touched because that person really saw you, understood you, and really thought about you and intentionally purchased that gift because it connected, you to them. And, when I think about my favorite gift, I think about, this little cupola above my head. My father and my mom gave that to me, and they, painted it and wrote Cupola's name on it. Or, my
Amazing.
brother, without being prompted, sent me a vintage postcard that had a cupola on it. And you can I cry easily. So when I opened both those presents, they connected with me because they, I didn't ask for them. I didn't specify I wanted these things, but it was a nod that they know me, they know the things that I like, and they are there to support me. And so, do either of you want to share your favorite gift?
Well, I'll tell you a little story. I spent many years and still do a little bit doing corporate training, and I was teaching this class, and in it we were talking about value, and we were talking about what are things that you value. And so we went around the room, and of course to find out what's something you really value, kind of like your question about what's a gift you got. And somebody would talk about a watch or something that had monetary value. It was usually, a guy talked about his car, a guy talked about his a collection of something, and things like that. And we got to one guy, and he turned and he said, "A cue ball." And I was, "Whoa, stop. A cue ball? You mean like a cue ball in pool?" He said, "Yes." "Why?" And he told this story about his father. And he said his father passed away, I believe, from cancer or something. And he said that him and his dad used to play pool all the time. And that's his connection to his dad. And of course, by that time, everybody in the room is like, "I'm good. I'm okay. I'm like you, Sarah. I cry at Hallmark commercials." So, but it's really interesting that one little story from that guy changed everybody's perspective on what was valuable to them, right?
I bet your workshop was amazing, Neil, but I bet they walked away remembering that.
Oh, hell yeah. That was exactly what they're. And I've told that story dozens of times, right? About what do we really value? What does value really mean? So I want to move kind of to the next thing. And this is kind of the other end of the spectrum, so to speak. Purposefully human sounds great, wonderful thing, something we should all be striving for. But what's the problem in the world? I mean, why, in your opinion, do we need more purposefully human behavior? What's going on out there? Why are we even having this conversation?
Yeah, I'm not sure we have enough time to dissect that whole problem, Neil. But some authors that I really look to when I'm having a hard time figuring things out, Esther Perel, if you're familiar with her, she wrote the book Mating in Captivity. She has a card game called Where Should We Begin that helps people have meaningful conversations. And she tells us right now that we are overconnected but underattached. And I loved when she said that. I like wrote it down and put it on my computer. Because I have three teenage boys, and so I see that all the time. I see them like being able to connect with their friends faster than I ever could jump on my bike and ride to my friend's house. But the interpersonal, like in-person reactions and time together seems to be lower than what I had as a kid. And so I don't know if it's like to use the term from the US Army, like VUCA. So it's like volatility, uncertainty, complexity, ambiguity. I don't know if our world has created this space where we are so uncertain that we are just creating these really small, insular kind of pockets in terms of not just the circles that we run in anymore are much smaller than they would have been, but also the way that we consume information seems to be smaller. And so I think all of those that make it really hard to be purposefully human to someone that's outside of that tiny circle that we have manufactured for ourselves. And I honestly don't know if we can ever get back to that level of connection that we used to have with each other. But I wonder if like one small way could be doing like these really, really small bids for connections, to use the words from the Gottmans, like a small bid for connection. If your friend pops into your mind, call that friend. Like I usually start by texting and I'm like, "Hey, you just popped into my mind. I'm thinking of you. Can I call you later tonight?" Because I don't think I still have a landline, so people can still call me at home, but I don't think we have that habit anymore just to pick up the phone and call someone. We're afraid we're going to bother them. But even just seeing your friends like missed call on your phone, you're like, oh, I wonder what they needed. So I think like those small bits for connection are a way that we can start to slowly kind of rebuild, certainly within that small circle that we've created, but then how do we ladder out? How do we meet other people in our community that need help? Or how do we like slowly start to build outside of this really insular world that we've created for ourselves?
So you're kind of drawing a distinction between connection and attachment, i.e., it and maybe I'm not hearing you correctly, so you can confirm. Are we talking about a level of intimacy here?
I think that's true. I think, intimacy, we often think of that word as like platonic
Romance,
between,
right?
yeah,
Romantically, something.
like I'm romantically
Right.
involved with someone. But I think in order to trust someone, you have to have some level of intimacy or vulnerability with that other person before I will ever share anything with you, because I need to make sure that you won't hurt me with that information I give you.
Because I mean it, because we all everybody talks about connection these days, got to be connected. We need to be connected. We need, but I think that this is presents a really interesting issue. Connection can be like the difference between transactions and relationships, right? I mean, okay, so I'm connected to 1,000 people. Do I know any of them?
I think that's like the best line from that George Clooney movie. What was it, Up in the Air, where he's like traveling all the time and he calls to check in with
Oh,
his
yeah.
sister, and she's like, "Aren't you lonely?" He's like, "I'm not lonely. I'm surrounded by all these people in airports all the day." But we see in the movie how truly lonely he really is, because you're right, Neil. Like, he's surrounded by all these humans, but he actually has no quote unquote intimacy or true connection with anyone else on a daily basis.
They're all superficial, very superficial kinds of relationships. And I can see that. I mean, we and unfortunately, social media has kind of promoted it. Get lots of likes, get a lot of followers, have all these people, and you feel good. And you look at your thing, wow, I've got thousands of followers. And then you realize, but none of them really know me.
Yeah. Who
Why?
could you call at 3 in the morning? Like, who
Yeah.
could you call stranded somewhere who would pick up the phone, A, and then B, help you out?
And you look at that list of followers and goes, heck, I don't even have their. I don't, half of them, I don't have their email address even.
Yeah, or
They're
their phone
just
number.
somebody who said, I like that and I'm following you. They're like subscribers to a magazine,
That's a good way of thinking about it.
So, with that in mind, what's something we can do? I mean, whether it's us individually or as organizations, or maybe you want to talk about both. What can an individual do and what can organizations do to be more purposefully human, to be more intentional about attachment or about understanding or about empathy, even? What can we do to be more human with each other?
The first one I'm going to tackle is something I don't do that well today, and so this is something I'm working on. But I'm working really hard to have a generous assumption of someone else. I have really good intuition, and so I tend to make like a quick judgment about someone else. But I realize that I need to try to collect more data for my gut about that person before I make that quick assumption. So, like, what can I know about that person? I did a lot of work in hospitals, and an old technique that we used to use is with new nurses, we'd ask them to, when they first go in to meet a patient, we'd ask them to take like a quick picture in their brain and then look to see, who does that patient remind you of? Like, maybe it reminds me of my Aunt Sue, or maybe it reminds me of my brother. And it's a lot harder for you to be mean to your brother in that bed than for you to be mean. Not that a nurse is going to be mean, obviously, but I think you know what I'm saying. Like, in terms of patience or how you're going to explain something, it's a lot easier for you to do that to someone that you have some affinity towards versus the stranger who that's the 14th time you've had to tell people, how this cuff is going to go on their arm. And I think, making those generous assumptions help soften us a little bit, because I think In this current world that we are living in, it's really easy to make a quick judgment about someone else and then just go from there and kind of write that person off. Like I said, I haven't figured this out all the way, but it's something that I'm working on. I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
Well, it's interesting you say this because this is why I think travel is so important. Years ago, my wife and I went to India, and she had to stay for business, and I had to come home. And on my way home, I'm sitting next to a guy who had been in Bangladesh, and we were flying over the Middle East. And the pilot came on, and he said, "Well, we have to divert the plane to go around a certain part of the Middle East because it's a war situation, so they couldn't fly through that airspace or whatever." And all of a sudden it dawned on me, and I turned to the guy next to me. I said, "You know, if more people would just travel and meet people, it'd be harder for us to drop bombs on them." Because I got to thinking, you know, what if we went to war with India? God forbid. But if we did, I don't know how I would feel. I would, you know, I know people there. I have friends there now. You know, it's a whole different kind of mindset you have when you think that way. And it's very similar to what you talked about when you were talking about dealing with patients. You know, you get to know them and it changes that dynamic. And you don't make those assumptions. You don't make assumptions. You know, and to my point, we go to a war, you know, got into a war, and you would think your assumption would be now they're evil. Well, I can't assume that they're evil because I know that they're not.
Right.
You know? So I think that's a really, really great first step, that this idea of generous assumption.
This other trick that I try to play on my brain is to think about that person that I maybe have a really hard time with in the moment as a 10-year-old. I'm not sure why my brain goes to 10, but I think about, like, man, this person. You know, they have a mom and a dad. They maybe have a sibling. They probably had, you know, some challenge in school, just like all of us did at one point or another. And some of the behaviors that we are exhibiting now as adults are to protect that small 10-year-old. And so maybe because this person is, you know, talking over me or talking down to me and making me feel small, maybe that's what that poor 10-year-old little boy or little girl had done to them. And once again, I'm not saying that I have it figured out, but these are some of the tricks that I'm trying to play with my brain so that I can try to stay in a, like an open space. And sometimes I'll even do things with my body language. If I'm on a phone call with someone I'm having a really hard time with, I will like put my feet far apart, like feet like hip widths apart, and then I will start doing like left right tapping on my legs. So like that bilateral movement can kind of calm my central nervous system down a little bit so I don't get
I
into
like
like,
that.
yeah, like my
Some
lizard
people
brain.
do
I don't want my
that,
lizard
right?
brain to turn on. So it's like I'm gonna try to tap so that my body will calm down and I will try to be more open and generous to this person I'm talking to, even though they're really irritating me right now.
Well, you're describing something that is similar to something I've taught in like customer service classes before. And I call it considering the iceberg, that everyone you meet, you only see that tip of the iceberg. And there's all this stuff under the water that you don't know anything about. You don't know the fact that they had on their trip over here, they went through a rainstorm, they stepped in a puddle, they had a bad morning, their kid's sick, their husband's leaving them. You know, all this stuff is sitting under. You don't know anything about. And instead of making the assumption that, wow, they're really not a good person, they're not, you know, they're not very nice. Yeah, well, if you knew all that stuff, you can put that picture together now, you know. And so again, that goes back to that idea of generous assumption. Make assume that people are generally good before you jump into, you know, you're a bad person or whatever, right?
Or ask your brain if you have enough data. Like, do I have enough data to make this decision? And that's where I get myself into trouble because I don't always have enough data. And I'm like, oh, darn, I should have collected more before I made that assumption.
Which goes back to your service design stuff, right? I mean, that's necessary, absolutely necessary in service design.
Yeah, and the work that we did with the city as it relates to service design, that was really exciting work because for many of us through COVID, we weren't able to get on site with our, you know, clients or customers. And so this was an opportunity for us to do all of those things again, to have one-on-one resident interviews, to do resident focus groups around very specific types of residents that we were trying to better understand. We did a lot of tabling events at community events. So, going out and asking folks, hey, here are three different types of residents, and here are some different services that we offer through the city. Can you help us better understand which of these services would help these three different residents? And so we'd have people put cards in these different envelopes. And the reason for that is we were trying to understand how people would group different services together. So if we as the city are trying to be more proactive and better understand our residents, we're a town of about 100,000 people. How could we, if you're a new resident, we already know that about you, right? You've just started your water, so you probably also need to start your trash. You probably need to know who your council person is. You probably need to know your neighborhood association and who's in charge of that. So, how can we move from being reactive and waiting until those calls come into our 311 customer service center and instead be proactive and do some outreach towards those neighbors who are new to town? And so, doing some of those, teaching those really foundational tools around empathy mapping. So, really understanding, to your point, Neil, around the iceberg, what are all of the other, day in the life of this resident? For us, it might be really easy. It's like, yeah, you just go down there, you get a permit for your fence, and you go home and start to build the fence. It's like, well, actually, if you are someone who's in a wheelchair, getting downtown is really challenging. Finding a parking spot is very challenging. Trying to navigate into this building. So, what are all the things that we need to be thinking about outside of just, yep, they're here to do this task, and then they get it and they go? And so, doing the persona work, doing the empathy mapping, and then putting it all together, we had the luxury of having all of these 30 cross-department team members together and saying, hey, here's the part that I own of this resident journey. Here's the part that you own. I didn't know that you haven't filled the same form that I already have over here. And so, how can we start to break down some of those friction points for the residents and ensure that we're kind of presenting as one city instead of different departments within the city?
And Lord knows if more companies would do that too, it would be helpful. I've already filled this form out. You already know this about me. Why am I telling you again and again and again, even in the same phone call? You call and you say, I'm so and so, and da 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 da, give me your 10-digit account code. And you do all that stuff, and then they transfer you to another department. Can you give me your 10-digit account code? It's like, what? I've already done this, and it just paints this horrible picture of the company. They don't care about me as a human being.
That's exactly right. And one of the things that irks me to no end is when you show me that you don't know me. When you show me you don't know me as a customer or a patient or a resident, I, once again, this goes back to my not being generous, but I'm going to have a really hard time coming back to you as a customer when I give you many opportunities to show me that you know me and you choose not to use any of them. There are some horror stories about that when you think about, someone who's pregnant and they unfortunately lose that baby, and then the diaper company still sends diapers to their house when that baby would have been born. It's like, how are we not leveraging this information so that we don't do things like that? Everyone uses Chewy as the example in terms of like the shining star, right? Like when you lose a pet through Chewy, they send you flowers. They tell you can donate the food. They'll take the food back. They'll take any unused items back so that you don't have to see that remembrance of your pet. What are some of those really intentional ways that companies can show customers that I matter to you? Right? Like my little $50 that I, purchased from your company, that matters to you. And you are looking at me as a longitudinal customer and not just a transaction.
It's like those stories I've heard of of Zappos when Zappos was still Zappos, back in the day, where they would get on with a client and a client would say, I need to send these shoes back. No, well, why do you need to send these shoes back? Because they were from my mom and she died. And they would not only say, absolutely, you can ship them back and get the credit back for them, we'll ship them for free. And they would, in the meantime, send that client flowers, and a card. And it was very obvious that it was very human, just ridiculously human. And Having experienced something like that myself with the opposite extreme with a company when my father died, and having to call place and say, I have to cancel this subscription or cancel this thing. And they would just take it like, well, why? What happened? Say, well, he's passed away. And you'd say it, and it was like, okay. It's almost like a cheerful, well, okay, we'll take care of that. Not a word of, oh, we're so sorry.
Send us a copy of the death certificate.
Yeah, or
Yeah.
that.
That was one of my, that was one of my favorites. Not.
That kind of makes me feel sick now just hearing that,
Likewise.
But
Hey,
how the
I can't help but jumping in with an observation. Whether it's Sarah, your work, or some of the stories that we've shared, or just the whole idea of service design and human-centered design and things like that, the subtext from all of this is taking a pause before you act, to give your mind, heart, and soul an opportunity to remember that you and the person you're talking to are human. And that seems to be one of the major ills in today's world. People are just using their lizard brain. Thank you very much for mentioning that. And they're just reacting, to the moment. But if you think about human-centered design, design thinking, whatever. I don't know that the method is as important as organizing a group of people to take a pause and think, and not just with the mind, but with the heart and your soul about what we're talking about. I don't know about you, but when I've done that kind of work, by the end of the workshop or by the end of the day, people are they're talking in a more human way, not just about the problem we're talking about, but with each other. So I'm wondering if we have a minute to just get Sarah's thoughts on this. How do we remind ourselves at scale to take that pause? Because that seems to be the fatal flaw in the way society runs these days. We don't take that pause. So we say dumb things, or we treat people badly, or what have you, and then we have to fix it. The thing that we just caused that was caused by lack of thought. Now we have to fix it. So now we have the original problem plus a new problem, and it cascades from there. So in your view, Sarah, how do we at scale, because this is something that we talk about in Purposeful Human, help people, how do we provoke them to systematically give themselves the grace to take that pause?
Yeah, I think some of the challenges that we've run into, specifically within our field of customer experience, is that we have defaulted so much to the metrics that we've lost all the humanity out of actually what those metrics represent. I worked for a survey company for 11 years, and I'm sorry to say, but I am sometimes anti-survey because it is seen as a kind of check the box. And so that's why I'm really pushing my clients now to do more one-on-one customer interviews, to do more customer focus groups, because it's a lot harder to argue with someone's story than it is to argue with, hey, you have a, an 87 NPS. People kind of tune out. It's like, oh, great, we don't have to work on customer experience. We got it figured out. Well, all three of us know, even clients that have a really great NPS, they have customers who are unhappy every single day. And so I think it goes more towards what kind of culture is the organization creating? Are they really seeding the type of behavior that they want to be seeing in their teams? And so what I mean by that is some work I've referenced in the past, but it's a group called Riders and Elephants. They're from Australia. They have this deck of cards that has emotions. So there's, I think, 60 different emotions, every emotion is on one card. And work that I've done with clients in the past is asking the team, how do you want customers to feel after they interact with you? And so they go through and they pick the top five emotions, and then I have them do for the undesirable emotions, how do you not want them to feel after they interact with you? And usually we see certain patterns pop up. There's some gravity in the room. People will say things like trust or secure or understood. And then I go to that team and I say, how do you think customers feel today? Right? I've already looked at their data prior to the workshop, so I kind of know the answer going in. And we, in that moment, have to hold ourselves accountable. It's like, okay, here's the ideal that we are saying that we all agree on, but here's the reality. And what's the delta between the two? Well, the delta is usually, to your point, Neil, like, well, we ask customers to reconfirm their account number on this phone call. Well, why? Do we really need to do that? Isn't there a way that we can transfer that information when we transfer the call? And so we have to then challenge ourselves to look at our processes and really understand, is this process necessary? Is it legally necessary? Must we do this? Or is this because it makes it easier for another department? How can we reapproach that together and redesign it together so that it's appropriate for our team and for our customer?
So we've touched on a bunch of stuff here.
Yeah, I had a few things I want to
Well,
pick up too.
and let's jump in a minute, but you talked about generous assumption, gathering more data as two of the big deals here. And Jerry, I love the idea of we need to take a pause. And I initially, right when you said that, Jerry, I thought, why don't people take a pause? And I think that there's some fear out there of taking
Absolutely.
fear from our workplaces, that they won't let me do that, or we've got this stigma against, we talked earlier about overconnected and underattached, but there's a stigma against attachment. There's a stigma against intimacy. There's a stigma against you can't get to know people. It's almost like everybody's a doctor now and you're not supposed to get to know don't get emotionally involved with your patients, which I don't know how doctors do that. I just don't. And but there's a stigma in particularly in our workplaces against that. Don't get emotionally involved with people. My thing is they're people. We don't really have a choice. You
Yeah, I
get
mean,
emotionally involved with people.
as a leader, I think you have to love your team or you can't lead them. I mean, I think that is absolutely what I have found to be true as a leader. If I have a hard time connecting with a team member, I'm not going to be a good leader for them. And I have to figure that out. That's my job to figure that out, not the team member's job. And so, I think you're exactly right, Neil, in terms of how do we make it okay to connect with another person on that level? And you have to go at that person's speed, right? Like you can't just jump in and start talking to that person and like dump your deepest, darkest secrets on them because that's not appropriate. But how can you make sure that you learn more about that person? And I think, being inquisitive is the best way.
Well,
Ask
I think
thousands of questions.
I think to your point, being a leader, I think leadership is service. And I think those two are deeply intertwined. You can't be a good leader if you're not of service to your team. But in order to be of service to somebody, you have to have empathy for them and you have to have compassion. You can't do it any other way. And in fact, I talk about in a book I wrote about the fact that business is essentially compassionate by nature. If we look at compassion as saying, well, compassion is seeing the need of another and wanting to help. Well, isn't that what business is supposed to be doing? But we're afraid of it. You walk in, if I walk into a workshop and I say, we're going to talk about compassion, you get a bunch of heads looking at you like, whoa, wait. This isn't church. This isn't, this isn't a charity. We're a for-profit company, and so we have this stigma about this thing that's it's hard. It's hard to overcome in our world today. So we've got about 5 minutes left with you, Sarah. So I really want to jump. And Jerry, you had a question, I think, a minute ago. Do you want to post that question or am I, did I miss
No,
something?
you go ahead. We have to be mindful of our time.
I wanted to ask you a really difficult question. I know I would struggle with this if I were asked it, so
Thanks.
you can throw darts at my picture later. But
I'm going
what's
to make a generous
something?
assumption about you, Neil.
Okay, good.
Good
At least
one.
somebody has today. What's something you see that's purposefully human, or I'm sorry, that's purposefully inhuman that we all accept kind of on a daily basis, but you know we could change it if we just had a little effort towards it? Can you think of
Okay,
anything?
I'm gonna try to do some more thinking, but the first thing that popped into my brain
Mm-hmm.
is when we see people parking in an accessible spot who do not have an accessible hang tag, and we all walk by that person and we can see that they themselves and are not being a caretaker for someone who is in fact wheelchair bound. Like, how can we as a group of humans let that happen? And I know it seems like kind of a silly example, but I think it actually speaks more to what you were saying earlier, Neil, is that we are afraid to speak out. We are afraid to say, like, hey, man, like, what if someone else who is really wheelchair bound needs that spot? Now they can't park in it because you're there because you wanted to just run into the store really quick to grab some milk. I think there's a lot of examples of that throughout the day. And another one that pops to my mind is when you're behind someone at the stoplight and they just throw trash out of their car window. Like, what are we doing? Why is this, or you're hiking on a trail and you see a bunch of fruit snack wrappers. I'm like, guys, we are in a very beautiful place, and sure, it might have fallen out of pocket, it might have been an accident, but like when you see a trail of like six of them, that's not an accident. And so I think all of these little moments, if my kids were here, they would be laughing at me because sometimes I will speak out in public about things. We were in New Orleans and we were at the City Park, if you guys have ever been there, and they have these beautiful, beautiful, beautiful angel oak trees, and they are, hundreds and hundreds of years old. They're very fragile. They are, kind of, some of them are kind of tethered to each other for strength. And there was this little boy bouncing on one of the limbs. And I was just so enraged that this mom would let their little boy bounce on this beautiful historic tree that is there for everyone to enjoy. And so, of course, I opened my big fat mouth and I was like, hey, like, we need to take good care of that tree. I don't think we should be bouncing on it. And it wasn't a good conversation back and forth, and I embarrassed my children. But I think those are some of the moments. It's like all of this is for all of us. And so if some of us feel like we can take liberties with things that belong to all of us, that doesn't feel purposely human to me.
So if we all would just pause and take a moment to think about the others around us, that would make a huge difference.
I think a
Sarah.
lot about it right now, in particular where I live. So I live in northern Indiana. I'm about 40 minutes from Lake Michigan. There is a lot of untouched farmland right around me. And so 20 minutes to the west of me, they are building an Amazon data center. They are building a battery plant, and it is generating a lot of revenue for my state. But I will tell you, if you go to some of the county meetings, they are also depleting the water of people's wells that live out there. And they are, taking away untouched Indiana prairie that we can never recover. I mean, once, Amazon stops needing to use that data center, let's say in 50 years, we can't recover that land to return back to prairie. And so I think maybe that's why those answers are heavy on my mind right now, because I'm seeing that in my own backyard, that this beautiful, we are kind of this, bog is what a lot of the ecosystem up here in northern Indiana is really unique, and there's a lot of things that live in this bog that we can't ever replace once we get rid of it.
Sarah, you have brought up so many awesome things. I think I'm making a note, must have Sarah back to talk more. I'm waiting for the Sarah Andrews book. You have been a delight, and I really appreciate you being here. And you have given us so much insight and so many cool things to think about. Jerry, do you have anything to say to Sarah before we let her go back to being a steward of the community?
Well, I'm going to talk about Sarah and embarrass her for a second, because I want to ask her a question. Sarah likes to point out that she has traditional Midwestern values,
Which is why my face is getting red right now.
and how some people have, what's the right word, Sarah, taken issue with that with you, or what have you, and. And I hear her talk about that, and I say, well, great. I think that's wonderful that you have traditional Midwestern values. So somebody with traditional Midwestern values, Sarah, what do you think about the fact that someday you ended up on a video cast with a bunch of crazy guys, and your observations and stories could be seen around the world? How does that, for someone with quote unquote traditional Midwestern values, how does that feel?
Well, in the words of my paternal grandmother, who was one of the closest people in my life, she would often say, like, "Oh, for dumb" is kind of her phrase. And I say that because the things that I'm sharing here with you and Neil today are nothing revolutionary. They're nothing new. I didn't come up with any of these things. They are things that I have been taught, or I have read, or I have consumed from others. And so that's why my face gets red, because I am not doing anything outside of what I think I'm supposed to do. And that's a St. Augustine quote that means a lot to me, is I deserve no praise, for I'm doing what I ought. And I truly try to live my life that way, because I think that, like all of us, we were all given very unique and special gifts. And the best way that you can be grateful for those gifts is to use them to serve others. And so that's how I view the work that I do. I'm so very lucky, and I'm so grateful that I get to do the work that I love doing, because not everyone gets to do that. Not everyone has the luxury of doing the work they love to do. And I do. And so I'm grateful for it. And I'm so thankful that the two of you asked me to join you here today.
Well,
Well,
what
thank you,
an awesome
Sarah.
thought. Yeah. What an awesome thought. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you channeling your inner Tolstoy. The purpose of life is to serve humanity. I love it. Thank you so much.
Thank
And
you both. It's been so fun. I appreciate it. All
we'll talk to you soon, Sarah.
right. Bye.
Take care.
So, Jerry, what, we've only got about 5 minutes. What is your, can you get it to one big takeaway, or a couple of big takeaways from Sarah?
And it goes something like this, Neil. I think what Sarah points out is to be purposefully human in our corner of the world. You don't have to be a famous author. You don't have to be, a subject matter expert or a thought leader or a famous writer or on all the right radio programs and things like that, a political party leader, a business leader. You need to be, I know this is going to sound a little trite and glib, but you need to be purposefully human in reality, and in real life, IRL, and I think the Sarahs of the world really prove that out. Listening to her talk and about her family, colleagues, friends, clients, etc. Sarah really exemplifies, she's modest about it, and that might make it even better. But she really exemplifies, To be purposefully human is to live purposefully human, not just to talk about it, or not just to bemoan the state of the world or what have you, but to do something about it in the ways that each of us has available to us. And yeah, I made the comment about the Midwestern values because I think sometimes people take liberties with what they think they know about you. And sometimes that phrase Midwestern values is used as like, well, you're just innocent naif in the woods. What do you know about the big city? But in reality, it also represents a way of interacting, which is very pro-social and very purposefully human. And I think Sarah really helped us see that today.
Well, I mean, I've got 2 pages of stuff here.
Yeah, same.
I love the idea of generous assumption, and that you need to gather more data on people and how that all kind of came out of that service design work, but it applies to all of us in a, with family, with friends, with the difficult, whoever we meet.
Right.
And I love your comment about taking a pause. And then she talked about, I said, well, what's the problem? Why, what's causing a lot of this? And she talked about defaulting to metrics. We make metrics such a big deal. If we can't measure it, it doesn't matter. And I've often decried that, that's false, because there's so much of life you can't measure. And I would even go as far as to say that the maybe the most important things in life you can't measure. You can't measure art. It's just art. You can't measure love. You can't. You love today, I love my kids a 10, or is it a 7? Nobody does that, right? She just brought up so many things that resonated for me. And so I was serious when I said, we got to have her back, because there's just so much, so much richness there and so many great stories. And I really look forward to that coming back so at some point.
I agree. And sometimes things come together in a way differently than you expected, but it was but better. I knew it would be very rewarding to talk to Sarah on our program, and it was in every way I expected, but it was even more because I think Sarah dropped some breadcrumbs that are helpful to us and purposefully human to understand, practically speaking, how do we move the world? Because as you guys were talking, that word take a that phrase take a pause just popped into my head. You can talk about the names of different techniques and different ways to organize your mind, heart, and soul, and what have you. But ultimately, I think they all require you to purposefully step back from the situation and make a choice about how you're going to respond. And if I contrast that to the way much of the world works these days, that's what people are not doing. So you get a lot of automatic behavior, as opposed to purposefully and thoughtfully human behavior in today's world. And that's, we're always trying to figure out in purposefully human where to focus, and Sarah helped, I think, today clarify one of those places. We need to understand why people don't take that pause and bring their entire human selves to whatever that situation is, as opposed to managing it like a transaction.
Well, with that, I will say it's time for us to go.
All right. Thanks
So,
so much,
Gary,
Neil.